Good morning, everyone. You are listening to the podcast, The Leaves of a Victim Nevermore, with Stephen Wilson. My name is Stephen Wilson, and I am a drug user, and I am a victim of childhood sex abuse. This one is going to be a little bit of a different show, I think, because I was really, really sick, and I'm going to keep the same format, but I normally tell people that this is for people that are experiencing some form of addiction, or they themselves were victims of abuse. Today's reading is going to be another Lovecraft. This one is going to be Herbert West, Reanimator. Of Herbert West, who was my friend in college in an afterlife, I can speak only with extreme terror. This terror is not due altogether to the sinister manner of his recent disappearance, but was engendered by the whole nature of his life work. The first gained in its acute form from the 17 years ago, when we were in our third year of our course at Mistatonic University Medical School in Arkham. While he was with me, the wonder and diabolism of his experiments fascinated me utterly, and I was his closest companion. Now that he is gone and the spell is broken, the actual fear is greater. Memories and possibilities are ever more hideous than realities. The first horrible incident of our acquaintance was the greatest shock I ever experienced. And it is only with reluctance that I repeat it. As I have said, it happened when we were in medical school, where West had already made himself notorious through his wild theories on the nature of death and the possibility of overcoming it artificially. His views, which were widely ridiculed by the faculty and his fellow students, hinged on the essentially mechanistic nature of life and the concerned means for operating the organic machinery of mankind by calculated chemical action after the failure of natural processes. In his experiments with various animating solutions, he had killed and treated immense numbers of rabbits, guinea pigs, cats, dogs, and monkeys, till he had become the prime nuisance of the college. Several times he had actually obtained signs of life in animals supposedly dead. In many cases, violent signs. But he soon saw that the perfection of this process, if indeed possible, would necessarily involve a lifetime of research. It likewise became clear that since the same solution never worked alike on different organic species, he would require human subjects for further and more specialized progress. It was here that he first came into conflict with the college authorities and was debarred from future experiments by no less a dignitary than the dean of the medical school himself, the learned and benevolent Dr. Ellen Halsey, whose work in behalf of the stricken is recalled by every old resident of Arkham. I had always been exceptionally tolerant of West's pursuits, and we frequently discussed his theories, whose ramifications and corollaries were almost infinite, holding with Haeckel that all life is a chemical and physical process, and that the so-called soul is a myth. My friend believed that artificial reanimation of the dead can depend only on the condition of the tissues, and that unless actual decomposition had set in, a corpse fully equipped with organs may with suitable measures be set going again in the peculiar fashion known as life. That the psychic or intellectual life might be impaired by the slight deterioration of sensitive brain cells, which even a short period of death would be apt to cause, West fully realized. It had been first his hope to find a reagent which would restore vitality before the actual advent of death. And only repeated failures on animals had shown him that the natural and artificial life motions were incompatible. He then sought extreme freshness in his specimens, injecting his solutions into the blood immediately after the extinction of life. It was this circumstance which made the professors so carefully skeptical, for they felt that true death had not occurred in any case. They did not stop to view the matter closely and reasonably. It was not long after the faculty had interdicted his work that West confided to me his resolution to get fresh human bodies in some manner, and continue in secret the experiments he could no longer perform openly. To hear him discussing ways and means were rather ghastly, for at the college we had never procured anatomically specimens ourselves. Whenever the morgue proved inadequate, two local Negroes attended to this matter, and they were seldom questioned. West was then a small, slender, speckled youth with delicate features, yellow hair, pale blue eyes, and a soft voice. And it was uncanny to hear him dwelling on the relative merits of Christ Church Cemetery and the Potter's Field. We finally decided on the Potter's Field because practically every body in Christ Church was embalmed, a thing, of course, ruinous to West's researches. I was by this time his active and enthralled assistant and helped him make all his decisions, not only concerning the source of bodies, but concerning a suitable place for our loathsome work. It was I who thought of the deserted Chapman farmhouse beyond Meadow Hill, where we fitted up on the ground floor an operating room and laboratory, each with the dark curtains to conceal our midnight doings. The place was far from any road and in sight of no other house. Yet precautions were none the less necessary, since rumors of strange lights started by chance nocturnal roamers would soon bring disaster on our enterprise. It was agreed to call the whole thing a chemical laboratory of discovery, should discovery occur. Gradually, we equipped our sinister house of science with materials either purchased in Boston or quietly borrowed from the college. Materials carefully made unrecognizable save to expert eyes, and provided spades and picks for many burials we would have to make in the cellar. At the college, we used an incinerator, but the apparatus was too costly for our unauthorized laboratory. Bodies were always a nuisance. Even the small guinea pig bodies from the slight clandestine experiments in West's room at the boarding house. We followed local death notices like ghouls, for our specimens demanded particular qualities. What we wanted were corpses interred soon after death and without artificial preservation, preferably free from malforming disease and certainly with organs present. Accident victims were our best hope. Not for many weeks did we hear of anything suitable, though we talked with the morgue and the hospital authorities, ostensibly in the college interest, as often as we could without exciting suspicion. We found that the college had first choice in every case, so that it might be necessary to remain in Arkham during the summer, when only the limited summer school classes were held. In the end, though, luck favored us, for one day we heard of an almost ideal case in Potter's Field. A brawny young workman drowned by the morning before the Summers Pond and buried in the town at the town's expense without delay or embalming. That afternoon we found the new grave and determined to begin work soon after midnight. Today's reading was Herbert West, Reanimator, from Lovecraft. Well, as I mentioned, this episode is going to be a little different because, as the title indicates, things got a little bit sketchy here. Beginning in mid-February a couple days ago, I got discharged. I lost about 4 or 5 weeks. The whole endeavor began with a slight cough and a little bit of a fever. And the next day, the body ache and you know, the diarrhea and all of that. Within a couple of days, I got tested in the nose and the mouth, just about every orifice I had. And I tested positive for influenza A. I was told to, you know, watch it. This one is, influenza A is actually more sinister than influenza B. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But they say you give it 4 to 7 days, let it go through you. They gave me some Tamiflu. They gave me one inhaler because I didn't have a nebulizer at home. It was Albuterol, which is a steroid. But it was on day 4 that I woke up about 2 in the morning. And I couldn't breathe. And I know that that statement has been tossed around, but the fact is I really was having a very hard time breathing. And I had a severe pain on my right side, like somebody had checked me into the boards. So I called the paramedics, I called the ambulance, 911. And they tested my oxygen saturation, and it was 82. So they gave me 3 breathing treatments in a row, which they shouldn't do, but they did. And they were able to get my oxygen saturation into 88. And then they took me to the hospital. And it was there in ER that they had the chest x-rays and the blood work up. And the influenza A had come into pneumonia. My right lower lobe, my lung, had become completely opaque. And I did study such things in school, but this time being on the receiving end, because I never actually had pneumonia in my life. And I've only actually had the flu once. So this was a little bit disconcerting. But I knew that there was something wrong. I knew it was the right choice. So they immediately admitted me the next day or the morning. And that is when they started me on my own kind of antibiotic. Well, no, that's not true. I was there for 2 days, and then they started the infusions. My veins started to fail, which meant that trying to obtain a reliable source of blood for the blood lab workup was becoming a problem. The original IV they put in ER on my right forearm failed. It began to overheat, and then it just got infected. Then they went on to my left arm, my left forearm, and that one also failed. And then they brought in a specialist to use a special machine to try to find a vein in my biceps. She was able to do that in about an hour. She did find 2 of them. But that failed the very next day. And then that is when I was told that CPIS had been found in the blood workup. My white blood cells were, well, it just wasn't good. And then that was the beginning. That is why I titled this 3 Days of Death, because that was day one. Because that is when they gave me an EKG. They were concerned that the blood infection would get into the heart chamber. And so for the next 72 hours, I was being checked in on about every hour. And now that I think about it, I crunched the numbers a little bit. I wound up having 60 infusions, 3 per day for 20 days. And then I had about 75 breathing treatments over the course of about 28 days, I guess. And I have to tell you that during those 3 days, I didn't eat, I didn't have a BM. I may have urinated a few times, perhaps, because they did have an IV for water to keep me hydrated. But I don't know what you know about CPIS, but basically your immune system turns on itself. And that is kind of that's a bit of a problem when you have influenza and then pneumonia. And they give you a few apparatuses, and to me, both of them resemble some kind of water bong. But one is for sucking and one is for blowing. And basically, both apparatuses, both bongs, are meant to break up the opacity that is in my lung, the pneumonia. The antibiotic I had was specifically built for me, and it was based on a derivative of sodium chloride. But it was specifically built for me because of the results from the blood lab. And then on day 2 of the 3 days, they took me down to radiology. And the surgeon inserted what's called a deep vein PICC line, because my veins were beginning to shut down, they were beginning to ghost. They were having a very difficult maintaining a sequence of infusions. So the PICC line was there. It went from my right bicep into my heart. And that's when they started another kind of infusion. And that is where they started drawing the blood. Because a deep vein PICC line is much more reliable for delivery of the antibiotic and also the retrieval of blood. And they started testing my blood every other day. And then when things stabilized on day 3, or rather day 4, my numbers, my blood cell count actually started to improve. The possibility of death had waned. So the 72 hours, I did survive. And then that's when the treatment began. Well, I mean, the treatment had already begun, but what I remember of it. Because I have to tell you, in those 3 days, I think about it now, and it seems like a blink of an eye. But when you're that sick, time, it moves so slowly. And the things where you would use as a metric, breakfast, lunch, dinner, when you would get your infusion, 5 a.m. to 6 a.m., 2 p.m. to 3 p.m., 10 p.m. to 11 p.m., the things that you would normally use as a metric when they come in to check your vitals. I'm diabetic, so they had to actually test my blood sugar 6 times a day, and because I wasn't eating. And I was only about a day away from them actually inducing nutrients into my IV with a PICC line. But the thing is that when you're that sick, everything takes forever. Everything takes forever. I know that's stupid, but that's what I said. Now, when I had my second EKG, they had found out the heart chamber had not been compromised. And that's when they transferred me to another hospital for long-term care. It wasn't a nursing home. It was a different kind of hospital. But this is where I would get 14 more days of infusions. And when I was debating whether or not to do an episode about this, I started thinking about what I actually thought about when I was in that second hospital, not the first one. Because the first one was kind of a blur by the time I got into ER, when my oxygen level was able to return to 88, 89. I was on oxygen the whole time. I was on oxygen up until the last day. And it was at 6L, so I was getting a lot of oxygen. But the things that I was actually thinking about, my own life choices, my underwear, where I'd had accidents with the diarrhea. But then, when I was in the second hospital, I kept thinking about how horrible the food was. Because when I had gotten past those 3 days, I became lucid, and I was starting to understand what was happening to me. I was starting to understand just how serious this was and what had happened. Coulda, shoulda, woulda, I guess. But when I was in that second hospital, most of it revolved around the fact of how to run a hospital like this. And I kept thinking about the food. Because they didn't have a diabetic choice and they had no fresh fruit. All the food was fried and there were starches all day. I actually had a hospital give me pasta. I'm a diabetic. That not only did they give me pasta, they actually gave me garlic bread. Bread, white, refined bread with butter and garlic. Now, these people are still testing my blood sugar. And of course, they're counting calories. No meal I had was over 900 calories. It was all about proportion. But I had never actually heard of a hospital giving a diabetic pasta. But that's what I thought of. Here I am. I have to acknowledge that I have a deep vein PICC line in my chest. I have diarrhea all day. Extremely weak. During this time period, I had lost about 12 pounds. My arms and legs had been compromised. I could walk. And there at the last week when I was at that hospital, I could walk around the building a few times. But the things that I thought of, my butt, my tailbone, because at first I couldn't lay down when I was in the original hospital. I couldn't lay down. I was coughing all the time. So my tailbone, it was just killing me. And they were giving me morphine for the pain in my lung. But I couldn't get the morphine all the time. And giving a junkie morphine, well, you know what that is. But when I was in that second hospital, I kept thinking about the sleeper needs to sleep. So the second hospital is not only giving me horrible food choices for a diabetic. They know how much weight I've lost. But then they keep waking me up. Vitals, blood pressure, heart rate, respiratory therapy, when they're giving me the breathing treatments, they're testing my saturation, blood sugar, meds, my infusions. The sleeper needs to sleep. In the last 2 days that I was there, the nurse asked me about what I did when I was at home. I said, I love art. I like to read. She's like, what do you like to read? Edgar Allan Poe, poetry. Lovecraft. And that was about Herbert West. Because now I know what it felt like to be on the slab. 11 a.m. Well, that's all I have for you. I know this isn't much of an episode, but I will make it back. I hope you are going to be a blessing, and I hope you find serenity. I survived. Thank you.